Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our series on examining the crisis at Pacifica and WBAI. The purpose of this particular discussion is to try to understand the issues, to do so as much as possible in an objective light. To understand that, I have interviewed many people, over 300 people, and have invited various points of view to be shared and their representatives. My interest is simple. What is necessary for us to create a healing environment? If I were to use a metaphor and I were to suggest that this station has cancer but is not terminal, the foundation is sick but is not going to die, and to get it well, we have to apply principles that honor what is necessary for healing. You cannot continue to have something get well or improve if the therapeutic model you're using itself is part of the problem. In the healing of almost every condition, there is known as a healing crisis. I do not always look at this as a negative. I look at it as one of the paradoxes. How many times have those of you in this audience, in our health support group, in the general audience, the over 45,000 of you I've counseled in my career, have said, gee, Gary, I feel worse. My skin is erupted. I have mucus pouring out of my body. I feel so weak. I couldn't even go to work today. And I say, good. That's part of the healing crisis. Because a week later, a month later, you're saying, whoa, I have energy I've never had before. I feel a whole new direction. I believe that if we can understand the real roots of the problem, can address positive solutions, that Pacifica, its mission, BAI, its other four sister stations, and many other affiliates will be stronger and better serve what it's supposed to do. I have not presented my own particular point of view, nor shall I. I don't see the purpose of it. I believe it would be counterproductive at this time. Instead, I've invited today Eutrice Lead. She is the interim station manager. I'm sure if you've been listening, you've heard that she has been challenged by almost everyone I've had on who would put themselves as a dissident. And in fact, at one of the recent meetings, and I told the people at the meeting, they're welcome to share any information with whoever they wish. Nothing at the meeting was to be said in confidence or any form of secrecy. I said, put it all out on the table. And there were people at the meeting, and I said, please do not attack each other. It would be counterproductive. Challenge ideas that someone has, that's fine. But then stop and let them respond. And to the degree that you can learn from someone else, maybe you have an idea of where they're coming from. Why do they have the idea they have? And at the end of it, I had suggested some 31 points that if we address them together, we could go forward. Instead, the two people of the, there were six of the dissidents and two from the board, Andrea Sisko and Ken Ford were there representing themselves, but also they had pledged to take everything they could back in and recommendations to the board. And I asked, let's have a cooling off period. Let's just cool off and see if indeed some good can come from the recommendations. And I thought, I want to thank one person in particular who not only did not attack anyone, but simply stuck with the agenda. What is needed to take us forward where the public benefits, the mission benefits, and we start the healing. And that was the former lab representative, and also I believe she was the shop steward and was worked in the station here. And that was Ms. Yang. Sybil Wong. And she came up with a lot of good ideas, and I want to thank her for that. Well, the very next day, Andrea Sisko's computer was broken into. a detailed list of all the people that she was employed by or was seeking employment and working on contracts. She's just a single person. She's not wealthy. And I'd already done a detailed background check on her, all the allegations against her. I went through every single one. And she went back, and I spent almost 2 hours the next day in the morning speaking with her about her going to meet with a full board and try to make changes. And she agreed to do that. And then I hear that she's lost her job because instead of cooling off, they went after her employer and threatened the employer if they didn't remove themselves from this woman, then they themselves would be the targets of a harassment campaign, boycotts. So they let her go. I felt that that was unnecessary, and it also did not show that people were willing to cooperate in a true spirit. And she said something interesting to me. She said, "Gary, I've tried to help BAI as a volunteer and then a local lab member, and then the lab voted me, recommending me to go to the national board." She said, "The people attacking me have never set to talk with me." You know, one of the so-called chief provocateurs against me has never asked me a question, never asked for me to defend myself. The assumption is I'm just guilty because other people said I'm guilty. So then everybody says she must be guilty. No one's asked, look at the facts. And if they had, maybe they would have had a different point of view. But she says, what does it mean when you get someone to agree to what you consider a democratic principle by illegally breaking into your computer, unethically intimidating your employer, causing you to lose your livelihood and to where you don't want to be associated anymore, where you can't afford to. She says, I'm a 60-year-old African-American woman, and it's not easy for me to get work. Now I have no work. I don't have a lot of money in the bank. I live in a middle-class neighborhood. I've got children and grandchildren. No one seemed to think about that, of what that means, just to be a human being who has been assaulted. How many people could be assaulted day in, day out, harassed, libeled, and want to be a part of a solution anymore? She said, well, I guess they won, because I'm resigning, and hopefully I'll go out and start my life over. And I thought about that for a moment. I thought, if we keep using the word democracy and proper freedom, and shouldn't it apply to everyone? Isn't democracy where everyone has an opportunity or right to express themselves? If the only way that you're going to get people to agree with you is by, in effect, getting rid of them, I don't understand the democratic principles of that. And I certainly felt that she was a moderate individual who was truly seeking to help in the changing process. So it was a big setback. That's okay. Setbacks occur, and we will find other ways of going forward, and I'm working on that now. I'm leaving on a very important trip a little later today, and I'll be back in about 4 weeks, and I'll continue on in that journey while I'm gone. Utrecht is at the center of this. At that meeting, one thing was said repeatedly by every single dissident. If you want anything to happen at the station, you got to get rid of Utrecht and Bessie, and then all of you. And then there was actually a list that went up on the internet, and the list said that in order for we to be happy, the dissidents, the people who are representing, as if, and I'm sure they don't represent all dissidents, and I believe there's some very conscientious dissidents who have important and legitimate concerns that must be addressed. But there are those people who've taken the position they represent, you know, the forefront. And they said, here's a list. Everyone on this list must be taken off every Pacifica station. Now, I looked at the list. It's up on the internet, and it's widely circulated. And it has me at the top, and every single person who did not support the dissidents. If people said nothing, they're considered the enemy. In fact, they're using, French revolutionary language. And so I contact one of these individuals. I says, well, I got a question for you. What if a person doesn't take your side? Are you equating them with being the enemy? He says, well, of course they are. I said, well, that means that you're so certain that you're right about everything that you're giving no room for anyone else to have an opinion. So if anyone disagrees with you, no matter what the basis of their disagreement, they're the enemy. They must be eliminated. Therefore, you're suggesting that everyone must be purged from every position, from a secretary to a cleaning person, on-air, producers, every single person in Pacifica, all stations in the network, must be purged so there's only one type of person, your type. Is that democratic? Is that what Lou Hill? After all, you all have not taken the time, I believe, to speak with the people who have not supported you, who have stayed quiet. Is it fair to say if you don't support your position that you're expendable? And there was a strong, well, you don't know the facts. I said, you don't know what I know. You send me emails, 1,000 emails, saying I should interview this person, I don't know that. I've done more research on this than anyone I know of on any side. People say they want the truth. Let me tell you something. Only those people who are not intimidated by the truth want the truth. Only those people who are not afraid of the consequence of the truth want the truth. An awful lot of people don't want the truth, including the people who broke in and took documents of my investigation and tapes of my investigation, which would have been extremely embarrassing to people had those come out. And I didn't believe at this time that it would be constructive in the healing process to tell people all that I know, because it would only alienate other factions. My interest is in seeing where do we go. Eutrice is in the studio. Thank you very much for being with me today, Eutrice.
Well, thank you very much, Gary.
Eutrice, I'm going to ask you some issues based upon people's perceptions who are challenging you.
Mm-hmm.
I would like you to put it in a context from your individual perspective, not as representative of BAI or Pacifica, but you as a human being. First, the word was and continues to be that you were a part of the coup. I have numerous memos. I have numerous emails. I've had dozens of conversations with people who are absolutely emphatic that you knew that BAI, here's the general scenario, you knew that BAI was being taken over as a part of an effort to sell off two of the stations for a lot of money so people could make an insider's profit who were on the board as much as 10%. By the way, you're aware of this because I gave you a memo on this from one of the people almost 9 months ago, and you responded to that memo to that person, but your response didn't change their opinion, that you had met with these people and conspired to eliminate a lot of people from the air. Your point of view. You'd give us your facts.
Well, the first thing, if we were to put a name to it, it would not be a coup. It would be a counter-coup. WBAI had been used, and I should say the listeners also were abused, by many people here who decided to put out false statements and absolute lies in order to whip up a kind of frenzy about Pacifica, when in fact the issue is very narrow and very personal. It always has been, and that is why I am not at all confused about what the cause of this morass is. I mean, the cause is quite personal. One individual in particular started lamenting in October that the program this individual hosts was being attacked, and that the individual also was being attacked, and I know it to be a lie. It started with a lie and compounded by other lies in order to satisfy a very narrow and personal agenda that is rooted in fear and rooted in a feeling, a philosophy, that there are no rules that need to be respected at all, and that if anything should happen, that this group, this one individual and a clique operating around this individual ought to be in absolute control. That, in fact, had been the case here at WBAI for quite some time. The general manager was, in fact, a victim of this. The former general manager was a hostage. And to some degree, the whole apparatus here at WBAI was held hostage to extremely fearful individuals, insecure individuals, who decided that it was within their birthright to be in control, and indeed did exercise that control. I'm different. I've never, ever been a hostage, and I do not intend to start that part of my career now. I have no interest in being anybody's hostage.
Let's go back for a moment. Try to be specific with details wherever possible so that we understand the difference between your opinion on events versus the facts that could support those opinions.
Well, Valerie Van Isler, the former general manager, had been through a series of counseling sessions and progressive discipline in which her performance was rated as being under par by the executive director, who had just come into that position and who had known her as a fellow station manager. Indeed, Bessie Wash was the general manager of WPFW, our sister station in New York. In Washington, D.C., sorry. Valerie Van Isler didn't tell anybody that beginning in June, she had been put through a number of steps, or had been advised to take a number of steps in order to improve her performance here. But she already had had a history with us here at WBAI that was not most pleasant. In fact, as I'm a former shop steward myself, and I do know that there were many, many calls for her resignation on a number of issues, which I really do not want to explore. I really have no desire to beat her up. In any event, Valerie did not share this with anyone, but did so at the very last minute. And she said that Pacifica was going to kick her out, and that's not true at all. Bessie Wash was extremely compassionate and held out to Valerie a very good alternative. She did not want to kick her out because Valerie, in fact, had devoted many years to Pacifica. She had offered her a different position. She had offered to pick up the expenses of commuting back and forth. She had offered her an increase in salary and offered to relocate her to an area where her skills could better be used. But in any event, she was clear that there was going to be a shift in management here. Valerie decided that she was going to resist it. She apparently had been counseled by people who had held her hostage here for so long, and the advice, of course, was to say no. That was married with a boiling cauldron of lies, already in full sway, that I'm being attacked, my program is being attacked, said one individual here, and Pacifica is to blame. Pacifica is a really nasty, awful entity, and they're trying to do me in, and I am the greatest programmer of all time, the Muhammad Ali of programmers. And that kind of movement was married with the resistance to Valerie, and in the last couple of days here, this entire station was sunk, not by anybody's volition, not by anybody's agreement, but the same group took it upon itself to sink the station into a state of unmanageability and chaos. There were individuals in and out of here who no one had any idea who they were. Nobody knew why they were here. They had commandeered our phones. They used our premises for sign-making and protest meetings and whatnot, and they were even discussing the idea of taking over the station by force if necessary. By then, Jose Santiago, my colleague here, who is the news director, was approached, and he agreed that he would step in. And he shared it with me, and I supported it. I thought it was a great choice because he's been with us for such a long time. He's a very pleasant person, very capable, very competent, very savvy. And I felt he would have been a good choice, and I supported him. Well, he made the fatal mistake of coming to a meeting, a staff meeting, and declaring that he was approached as the next person to fill in the slot. And the next time I saw Jose, he was torn to shreds, psychologically and emotionally torn to shreds by his so-called colleagues, who did not see it as being in their interest that he should step in. And they did such a job on him. They were so merciless. They were so offensive and foul that they brought the kind of pressure that made him bow out completely. By then again, the station had been seized by this clique running around deciding that their will was the popular will. Many of us were very opposed to it. We had people actually in here. Michael G. could tell you, people telling him, read this, do this, say this on the air, announce this. It was chaotic. I got a call after I did a program one day talking about the fact that I'm very clear about the nexus of this whole so-called struggle, which I thought was a temper tantrum, that people with unresolved issues decided that they would export to the listening public. And after that program, I got a call from Bessie Wash. And it was the first time I had contact with her. And she told me she was frustrated because she didn't know what next to do. She had asked Jose to step in, and now he had bowed out. I said, oh, my goodness. And she said she was about ready to name someone. Well, I saw the writing on the wall, and I said, look, if you give me 2 days, I will talk to Jose and really work at convincing him to step back in. I think I could do that. She said, okay. I asked her to hold off making any decision, and she did, which I appreciated because we'd never met each other. I talked with Jose over the next 2 days. We talked extensively, and he was adamant. He was just not going to deal with this. He was also dealing with some pressures. He had some health issues in his family. But beyond that, he had no appetite for the kind of discourtesy and the reckless disregard people had been treating him with, and he just didn't see that he was going to be useful, and he was not going to tolerate it. And he was clear he was not going to change his mind. And in fact, during the course of our conversation, he kept saying, look, you're the person I think ought to step in. You have the kind of guts, you can deal with this, I can't. I said, well, I have different plans. I have other plans. I have things I want to do this year. And in fact, we started talking. I came back and talked to others here, other colleagues of mine. And I vetted their interests and figured out what it was that they thought I should do. And the reaction was the same. They thought that I should step forward. Because now we were under a deadline. Bessie was clearly going to name someone. We didn't know who. It could have been Joe Doakes from East Bubba Yuts. We had no idea. And the fact that she already had given a signal that she was interested in somebody from the inside, we felt we didn't want to blow that. And I did call her back in 2 days, and I said I could not convince Jose to change his mind. In fact, I'm embarrassed to say what he said and others said that I should do, which is to nominate myself. But I have some concerns, and I want to explore those with you. And she said, fine, I'll come up and we'll talk about your concerns. And she came up the very next day, the Saturday, and we talked. I laid out a number of my concerns. It happened that she shared them, and she was willing to work with me and, in fact, was emphatic about the need to create some changes here. We had not, for example, had a negotiated contract at WBAI since 1995. We had people who were working who had no medical coverage, nothing. No benefits at all. In fact, Samori Marksman died, and I don't want to go through that. We had horrible situations here, horrible working conditions, and she was emphatic that they should change. And I laid out my points, and she agreed to every one of them. And I said, fine, then let's get it done. And the first thing she said to me was, well, what do you need to do? I said, I need to take hold of the space. This space has gone to hell. We have a bunch of people running around here deciding that WBAI had become protest central and impeding the work of the rest of us. And it was a very unsafe situation. And in fact, by then, they had planned to seize the station. And I said, I need to get control of the space. By then, of course, it was clear Valerie Van Isler would not turn over the keys. And even if she did, we needed to secure the space. So I said, I want all of the locks changed. And she said, fine. And, well, it was a big job. It was over the holiday season, and we spent, three of us, we worked on trying to find a locksmith who could come in and do it. We found one locksmith, and he said he could do it, but he would need the help of his sons, who had regular jobs, and he said they will come after 8 o'clock at night, and I said, fine. They came at about 9:45, not the middle of the night, but 9:45, and we changed the locks. And we began to take back the space and restore some sanity to it.
Thank you. Let me add in a few things. Tell me whether this is correct or incorrect, based upon my own research. I've interviewed people who had access to the memos and whatnot around Bessie Walsh. Bessie Walsh originally it was suggested that she have someone from BAI take over Valerie's position. In fact, there have been numerous memos, including one signed by a lot of people here at the station, and it was actually written by Samori Marksman. I actually have the memo, and where they just were not happy with Valerie. I had written myself over 100 memos over the years to Valerie Van Isler, including not to move to this location because I didn't see that the station could afford it, and also to bring some standards to the air, accountability, mm-hmm. so that anybody who thought they could say anything with no one being having to account for anything in objectivity or honesty or anything, I didn't believe that was good radio, and I certainly didn't believe that it had anything to do with the mission. I believe that to be responsible, to share something, you have to try to be responsible at the higher level. And I'd send all these memos to her. And also about the premiums never getting sent out mm-hmm. and people ordering premiums. I felt particularly bad because I've always raised the most money for the station in the history of all non-commercial radio. And it makes me feel very uncomfortable when I always have the thought, are they going to honor the pledges? And then I come down here and I see 700 of my premiums that I gave to the station sitting in a room after they took the money 2 years later because no one mailed them out.
Well, I showed you a room full of premiums that we have unearthed.
Yeah, well, there must be 2,000 premiums in there. A lot of premiums.
I showed you what we had to discover, and that speaks to the quality of management we had.
Well, I'm separate from anything else. I had my own issues about what was wrong, where I was having then to apologize constantly for things I had no control over that I believed that could have been done more professionally. I didn't believe that because you're a non-commercial radio station, you have to have low standards. To say that anything that represents a professional business model is wrong and can't be trusted or used, or you're selling out, is irresponsible.
Well, what you're pointing to, Gary, is something that we have known here for a long time, and that is we have been unable also to face up to it. And that is the problem, and I've said it on the air, the problem is right here. The problem began here. The problem is not, quote, Pacifica. We are Pacifica. The problem is that this station had been operating in dishonest ways for a long time. But because that dishonesty served a very narrow group of people, it was okay. They could do whatever they wished. They could break whatever rules there were. They could stretch whatever it is they needed to stretch. As long as their little program and their small needs were met, everything was just fine. You're talking to a person who was denied pay for 2 years and medical benefits for an additional 14 months after that. So I know about these practices. There are people here who have not been denied a thing. There are people here who controlled out, who had a signing authority on our checkbooks. That is before the accounts, the books were seized. Nobody wants to talk about these things, but I'm saying that it's about lies. It is a lie, and we have to just excoriate liars in our midst. People who have been leading very dishonest lives, very unethical lives, who have been doing very unethical things. You started off the program talking about Andrea Sisko, a wonderful, wonderful woman whose entire life has been about what? Bringing people together. The work she does is diversity work. That's her life's calling. To have somebody go up to Maine, and we have the person did that here, from here. One of the leaders of this dissident movement went up to Maine to make sure that bread could be taken out of her mouth. I don't have the words to describe what I think of people who do things like that. And simply, and even though she was attacked this way and vilified this way, she has been such a graceful, generous, charitable, sweet person. She remains that.
From my own perspective, Andrea Sisko, even after they illegally and committed a felony by breaking into her computer and got her to lose her job and her livelihood, she refused to say a negative thing about anyone. I spoke with her later that day. I spoke with her that night and the next day. And she said in spite of the fact that she was stepping down, she had to because she could not support herself financially, she would not attack anyone. I respected that. That shows great integrity. She would not demean anyone. And she would still continue to contact the board members. She still took the memo I gave her on 31 points to healing. And she said, I will do everything I can to still allow this, if I can, to push it forward. I think that shows a very remarkable person. Until someone has been personally attacked, until someone has had things done to them that some of these people have had, I don't think you can appreciate the consequences. To say that anything is all right as long as we ultimately gain control of something, yeah. Then how much different are you than the people that you're attacking? If what you believe the people are doing you're attacking are wrong, to use any means to get that power back, I don't believe is constructive on any level, spiritual or even ideological. That said, however, I want to go back to a particular point. So here we have a situation where many people, including many of the dissidents, were very unhappy. And I have their signatures. You know, I have so much evidence. I have people saying, we don't like Valerie's management style. Now, Valerie's a human being. I've always found her to be gracious. I found her to be a level as far as a human being. I would not say anything, nor would I respect things said about her on a personal level. But I'm only talking about the quality of her work in relationship to what I personally experienced that I was unhappy about. So when Bessie began to make a change, the board members that are being attacked were not notified. We're going to go change the station manager because it's not the board members' position. The board has nothing to do about changing managers. Bessie made this on her own. Forget Bessie for a moment. From multiple independent corroboration, the facts as I have them are that she came to first after the hearings and or the meetings in June, where she was told that things had to change or she would be changed. That was 6 months.
Yes.
Things did not change. And then when she was met again and there were witnesses at that meeting, it was not to fire her. Rather, it was to say, we're going to give you a $7,000 increase, that's the amount, give you a position of executive producer with programming at Pacifica in Washington. You can commute, we'll pay for those expenses. Someone also said that after that meeting, Bessie was crying because she felt so bad of having to, you know, deal with it this way. And because she didn't like to see anyone, you know, change, but it was actually a constructive change. Valerie did not want that change to occur and made that clear. And so there were numerous other meetings where Bessie said, well, keep your mind open to it.
Yes. This is from June straight through December.
And then finally, at a meeting that occurred in late October, she made it clear that or November, that was going to happen. There was going to be a change in management. Please take the offer, because she was not going to stay a station manager. And from Bessie's position, she was going to put in a manager from the station.
Yes.
And because she had known Jose, and because she'd offered him the position of national news director, though he didn't want to take, because he wanted to stay in New York and not be in Washington, Jose was the person.
Yes.
This had nothing to do, from their point of view, of selling BAI. It had to do with simply changing a manager.
Well, the thing is, that people who claim that Pacifica is contemplating, or still is contemplating, the sale of any of its properties simply cannot produce the proof of it.
Well, I'd like to see the evidence, because
I have
the original memorandum from Michael Palmer, and I have an in-depth interview with Michael Palmer. And I'm inviting Michael on, because I think it's very important people hear him talk about what he was going to do and why. I'll just briefly share this with you. Michael Palmer said, and I'll quote him as close as I can.
Well, I think you should identify him. He was a former treasurer of the Pacifica Foundation.
Yes. And this goes back to when they were doing a five-year projection. And there was a meeting, of which many of the people from BAI and all the other stations met in San Francisco, to decide, what do you want? And he said it was like, all right, if you could have anything you wanted for the future of your station to make it better, what would it be? Well, they wanted, you know, better pay. They wanted more news programming. They wanted a lot of things. And he took a look at all this wish listing and said, this is a lot of money. We don't have this kind of money. And then he said, I came up with an idea. The idea was we could switch channels. Switching channels means that we would take a BAI at this 99.5 location and sell that position and buy another one further down on the dial, take the money from that, and build all of their wish lists. It had nothing to do with changing the program format or content. Though they would later have one person who would say that, you know, didn't have a large enough audience. That wasn't the issue. The issue was there wasn't enough money to have the kind of quality stations run, because they were running in the deficit, and BAI consistently in the deficit in the red. And they also wanted to see about opening up some other non-commercial stations in the Midwest and places that don't have...
Do you see, the people who are saying this, and this is why I have zero respect, they know, because they're supposedly seasoned journalists, they know that this is a lie. It is a lie to say that Pacifica was going to sell WBAI or any other station. They know it's a lie, but they continue to repeat it because it fits into this program of just riling up the masses for other agendas, which are very much hidden at this point. They know it is a lie. And the veracity test has never been placed on these folks who are making these claims. They always insist that you ought to disprove this, or I must defend that. No, I'm saying I am insisting on applying the veracity test to the people who are making these specious claims. Not a single scintilla of evidence has been offered, and they've been able to get away with a program that would make the vicious anti-abortion faction look tame by comparison. They use these terror tactics in order to get another agenda fulfilled.
All right, let's back up for a moment. The documents that have been put out there, that there was going to be an effort to sell Pacifica, certain Pacifica stations, and change the bylaws that would allow them to have self-selecting control and deny the input from the lab boards. The There was never any formal effort to sell Pacific. If anyone has such a document, I'd like to see it. I've seen the memos. I have talked with the people, and those were rejected. In fact, the very people who were attacked rejected the idea. And then on the change of the bylaws, that was something that was not... first of all, the interpretation on that was not correct. In fact, the dissenting members of the board were the ones who suggested the change in those bylaws, and I had the memos on that.
That's correct.
And I would later, in one of my interviews, I said, now, you're attacking people who changed the bylaws. Did you not recommend this? Was it not your idea? And did you not agree to it? And did not the entire board vote unanimously for this? Well, then why are you selectively saying that these people on this side were wrong for doing something that you suggested?
Again, it's again about integrity and ethics in journalism. The people reporting this, if they are supposedly seasoned reporters, ought to know what a draft looks like. And they should know the sequence of events. The sequence was very simply the sequence that John Murdoch had put out here, John Murdoch being the head of the governance committee. The board, as a board, decided that it was time to revisit its own bylaws and to update them, which is a task of the governance committee, which John Murdoch heads. He being the only lawyer on the governance committee, the task was given to him. John, why don't you figure out what it is we need to anticipate as a board for any and all eventualities. He went ahead enthusiastically and came up with a whole bunch of bylaws that would cover just about everything from soup to nuts. The people who have it in their agenda simply to make trouble, is the best way I could put it, descended on this clause which addressed what the board had to do, and it was a very complicated legal thing that the board has to do if it chooses to sell any of its properties. But that was part of a draft document that was sent back to the governance committee members, and the board as a whole was going to revisit this thing and vote. See how the new bylaws, as suggested, compared to the old bylaws. And then they would do one from column A, one from column B, and then argue with it and come up with the final document. The folks who are telling us that they're such great reporters apparently are unable to distinguish what a draft is. And once it was addressed, it's not enough. It is not enough that the explanation is quite rational, because the lie needs to persist. So they continue to repeat this lie. And the more they do this, the more I now question the veracity of their own journalism. If you continue to report lies, if you continue to distort the truth, then I cannot trust anything you say. For example, there would be 10 people downstairs, and we would hear on our own air, hundreds or thousands of people showed up. Look, if you're going to be that petty and that unethical in your own reporting, you have nothing of value to offer me as a consumer of information. I cannot trust what you say. Therefore, I dismiss you from my consciousness.
Let's go back for a moment on a few. I want to revisit a few points. One of the contentions has been, and I went right after this one, are we trying to see, is the Pacific Board trying to sell the stations? Are we seeing this this effort to dismantle and to gut the management within different stations? I spoke with the people who had come up with suggestions, and several people, including several of the dissidents and one of the financial leaders of the dissident movement, actually personally, 2 years ago, when we were running around Central Park together, this man said, the BAI wants to pick itself up and clean its image up and improve its broadcasting and better pay for its people at On the Air, then it's going to have some money, and it's not going to do it from its listener base. Too much of the radio is simply unlistenable. It's just bad radio. Forget what cause it is. It's just bad. And he said, and this is his words, he said, what I would do is I would switch channels. I would sell the station for $200 million, take that money, plow it back into upgrading all the different programs, get real good producers in there. And he made an interesting comment. He said, if you have an opportunity to do a show that is in the full range of expectation what Lou Hill would have wanted, that honors the mission of Pacifica, you have a choice of having someone at high in quality, medium, or low in quality. If you want to sustain a larger audience, you don't have to tap into Mid-America audience, which is commercial radio, to do that. And he specifically mentioned ABC. He said, you don't have to have a Rush Limbaugh size audience to have a quality audience. He said, the trouble is, it's like a bad macrobiotic restaurant, because he and I had just eaten one about 2 days earlier, and it was terrible. But everybody else in there had accepted it. Like, oh, this is good. And I said, it's not good. It's not clean. And he said that he felt bad the next day. He had a sauce. He got sick. And so he's using the analogy that the audience at BAI had learned to accept lower standards than what you would get in any other form of radio, because it was what was expected. It's almost like, and I mentioned this to him, I said, I can appreciate that because my audience almost rarely expects to ever really get all the premiums. You know, if they get them, good. If they don't, well, they're really given for the cause. But I said that shouldn't be. And he said, well, then you're going to have people who are accountable and bring in professional skills. The trouble is, when you go out there and ask for professionals, then you're going to cause a conflict with people or not. And how are you going to get them off the air if the people who are unprofessional or not accountable or don't honor their audience or don't do their homework, what if those people are going to fight you and make it seem like there's a major sabotage? And I said to this guy, I said, it took us 6 years of listening to a rabid anti-Semite on the air who hated all Jews. You know, it didn't matter. And I didn't know that he was being paid. And one day I found out that he was paid. Well, he had no audience. And I mean, it was like a flatline audience. Just a couple people, I guess, who love hate radio were listening, or who hate Jews were listening. But I was earning money for the station, none of it going to me. I didn't have a paid producer, telephones, ISDNs, myself, nothing. My money from my audience, which are primarily Jews, including Orthodox Jews, who had met with me, the rabbis had met with me, and said, Gary, we appreciate you and your work, but we cannot support you and your work because the money is also going to support programs that are against everything that offends us in our religion, our beliefs. And so I said I went in one night, I asked this guy, I said, why do you find it necessary to hold these positions? I have a right, you know, this is free radio. And I said, well, yes, it is. But is there a responsibility to uphold a standard, even truth? Do you believe that freedom also gives you the freedom to lie? Should we support your right to lie, to alienate, to cause harm, or disturb the image of other people to where people would indeed look angrily at other people who have committed no crime against humanity or anyone else? I said, I don't have to support Palestinians or Jews in order to try to understand the nature of their conflicts and the rights and wrongs on both sides. But I haven't heard both sides presented. I've heard one side presented, and always with such destructiveness. Then I found out he was paid. That really concerned me, because then I started seeing the selectiveness of who was in that circle.
It happened here for quite some time.
Who was in the clique? And where I was told there was no money for any of this, and we all had to be volunteers. And then I realized, and the guy who I was running with knew about this. And he said, well, you realize that to get one guy off, which finally took 6 years, and the only reason he left, the program directors that tried couldn't get him off the air. I actually remember once I was sitting in a program director's office, and this program director had given a memo to someone that they wanted to shift their hours. Guy came in, started screaming, picked up a chair and whacked him. Nothing happened. No police were called, nothing. I saw physical abuse, sexual abuse. I saw things would have ended up people getting in jail if it were, but it was kind of like that was the standard. You could do anything, say anything, no matter what you did, it was simply accepted. No matter what went out on the air, accepted. So when we had people, phenomenal people, Lex Hicks and Eileen Zalist, Eileen Zalist quite simply is one of the best science reporters in the history of radio, couldn't take anymore, the abuse. And we've had good people. We've had some of the best people you can find, not only upholding the mission of Pacifica, but upholding the higher standards also, head-to-head with the best in commercial radio or NPR. But those are the exceptions.
Well, and the good
and
news.
That what the guy, so the guy said, he said, if you had the resources and the station manager could go out there and say, here's what, you know, is open, here's the kind of programming to serve this community, but let's take it to a higher level of accountability. And you have to have resources to do that. And you have to have a station program director and station manager and department heads who will stand behind that. Here's our standards. Can you meet them?
Well, I have a question. It's amazing to me that at this
point... By the way, this person is also partly now part of the group that is attacking for the idea of selling it. And when I got his letter to me, and he said, you better get on board and be one of the dissidents. I said, no, I'm not going to get on anyone's side here. I'm on the side of the station, and whatever facts I can find as a journalist, I'm going to then look at the direction that I would go. And I said, but aren't you the one who told me that switching channels would be good, that you would just get the money? And he said, well, yeah, but that's different. I said, different? That's all that this guy offered.
I just want to ask a couple of questions. This person who knows very well what to do and all the solutions.
Yeah.
Did this, and the person who continues to fund the anti-Pacifica effort.
Yeah.
Did this person, was this person not a corporation?
Yes, one of the biggest. $100 million a year plus. $150 million a year.
Didn't this person, in fact, go bankrupt?
Yes.
Didn't this person, in fact, how many jobs were lost when bankruptcy was declared?
743 or
more. Great. So what I would suggest, and this is why I'm saying I have an entirely different barometer as to who really I should listen to. If you are a failure in something, a field that you know intuitively, you're supposed to know this, and if you are a spectacular failure at that, why am I supposed to be sitting here listening to you about something about which you do not know? If you know the mail order business, and it's a self-guided missile and you fail at that, and 800 people or 700 people lose their jobs, if you fail at that, I'm supposed to now sit down and listen to your ramblings about radio, about which you know absolutely nothing.
Well, this person would disagree.
I know.
He believes he knows everything about everything.
Well, that's my point.
Because he's never
asked
advice.
It's about a lot of people deciding they know a lot about everything. And I'll tell you why they know a lot about everything now. They know a lot about everything at this juncture because there has been a shift, a paradigm shift in many, many ways and at many, many levels. This station is beginning or has begun to look like New York. That is, the complexion of WBAI is changing and has changed. The audience has changed.
In what respect?
The audience, in the sense that we know, because we have the figures, we know who is supporting this station. The African American community, the Latino community, and the progressive, I mean truly progressive white community. Not the people who yammer and scream, but people who are committed to justice, people who are committed to struggle, people who are principled and who are clear in what it is, what differentiates struggle from the screaming folks out here who are just simply trying to expiate the demons that have been hounding them since childhood. Real struggle doesn't look like this. It doesn't sound the way it is sounding now. It doesn't have as its modus operandi terroristic tactics and violence. That's not struggle. It doesn't lie. If you're going to be principled, you can't lie and still be principled. You can't. And practically every single leading person in this movement, I could point to 504 ways that they lie and have lied and continue to lie.
Without mentioning individuals, which would not be fair since they're not here to defend themselves, I would like you to focus on the lies. If you say that you can name them, then please name the specifics.
We already explored a couple. The WBAI was going to be seized by Pacifica, which is stupid to say in the first place, because we are Pacifica. Pacifica owns us. They can't seize us. They own us.
Well, as you go through each one of these, I just want to give a little bit of awareness from my own research. I could find no documents to support at any time that there was ever an effort by anyone at the National Board to seize Pacifica.
Or never.
This was a management decision by Bessie Walsh, who had that right. In fact, the board members were actually informed that I spoke with after the fact. Now, the fact that you were not made aware until the Jose did not take it. By the way, in Jose's meeting where he went in and he waited, and then he finally at the end of the meeting said, as people were leaving the room, well, I've got something to tell you. I'm that person. Mm-hmm. And they identified him. I don't know why he didn't identify himself at the beginning of the meeting. Some people actually were supportive of him. Some people questioned it, but did so in a non-aggressive way, in a legitimate way. And some people were not as supportive. That's not what caused him, from my interview of Jose, to reject the station manager position. It was the personal phone calls, the one-on-ones, where people were up in his face.
Yes.
And telling him that not only would they not support him, but they would make his life miserable.
Miserable, they said. And they will make the station unmanageable.
That's correct. And they said that to him one-on-one and over the phone. And he had so many calls. He said he had dozens of these calls over and over again. And he just realized, what am I stepping into? At this point in my life, I don't need any of this. Because he had seen how power playing at the station had been dealt with in the past, especially on the part of people who were relentless in maintaining the little power cliques. And by the way, just there's no secret that in the entire history of BAI, and I can only speak for BAI, small groups have controlled the station and virtually controlled the management.
Absolutely.
I can tell you
that is a fact.
I will tell you one fact that is absolutely 100% irrefutable. I walked into and this goes back some time, I walked into a station manager's office on a Monday morning and explained what I had discovered at the station being done on Saturday. And the person looked up at me and I said, if this were made known, the station would be closed instantly and the license revoked in a heartbeat. I said, you were aware, you should have been aware, if you're not aware that these problems are going on. And the person says, what am I supposed to do? Now, that's as much as I will say on it. I've seen being here. I've seen what happens when professionals try to do a professional job. And I don't believe that we should reject automatically the idea that professionalism means that we have to abandon a mission. I believe you can do a mission better if you're professional at it. This whole idea that only people who have an anarchistic or socialist or communist background are capable of either understanding the mission or honoring the audience is very self-serving. In a truly...
Well, they give anarchy a bad name.
Well, yeah.
Anarchy is the concept in anarchy is that you are so self-disciplined that you don't require any overarching disciplinary power.
Well,
but that's not what we have here.
Well, I know from myself that there are times when I simply cannot listen to some of the programming, and some I really appreciate that it's remarkably good, and others is remarkably bad.
Yes.
But there's been no way of changing it. Even some more marksman sat in my home one night, and he said, he went over all these things that he wanted to change station, and he was talking about his frustration. I was kind of like the where he vetted out his anger at the end of a day, or his frustration at the end of the day, because he was generally very mild-mannered. And he said he gave me a list of people who he didn't believe should be on the air because they were just not good radio, not good at what they did, and the type of audience that were listening to them was not an audience that even was a part of the original mission. But he said he couldn't do a thing about it. He said, that's the bad part of this, Gary. I can't do a thing about it, because the moment I do, it's nothing but a battle, and I just can't be screamed at all day long, every day, by people who feel they can act like children and do this. And I said, Smore, you got to get away from this station. You got to take a break. If you don't, you're going to end up dead of a heart attack. Well, he'd end up dead of a stroke. Unfortunately, because he couldn't pull himself back. And I even suggested he take a job elsewhere, you know, at another radio station. He was looking at other options, by the way, because he saw there was only so much he could do here. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM.